It's Great Mondays Radio. I'm Josh Levine, your host, founder of Great Mondays. We help executives from hypergrowth technology and social enterprise organizations build cultures that attract, engage, and retain top talent. If you'd like to be a guest on our program, hang out for about 20 minutes and I'll tell you how. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Great Mondays Radio. It is almost time for the fall when plenty of sports leagues are back in back playing games. And today we are going to talk a little bit about sports. We don't often talk about sports. We're going to talk about sports leadership and how what we can learn from a former Major League Baseball executive who is a World Series winning. He's a World Series winner. And he works with high and elite performers now as an advisor and executive coach. Joe Boringer, thank you so much for coming on Great Mondays Radio to talk about what you learned in your journey as in the pros, as an executive, and how you are actually helping leaders now learn from what you have learned throughout your journey. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm really looking forward to the conversation and hope it's worthwhile for the listeners today.
I'm sure it would be. So let's go a little bit with, I think folks have got to, we got to start with the background and we sort of promised this. So you started your career and have been in and around professional and baseball specifically for many, many years. Let's start with your kind of where you come from and why you're showing up here.
Sure. So super fortunate. I was one of the few that actually the first career path I chose actually ended up being the career path for 30
years. That is rare.
It is rare. So I started out as a business when I was in business school. I went to MIT, and while I was an undergraduate student there, started working in baseball through internships, and eventually made that my career. Started out working in the office doing rosters, contracts, transactions with the players. That in turn grew into helping out with player development and scouting. I was in the office for 10 years. I was out in the field scouting, traveling, seeing players for trades, free agent signings for 10 years. And then back in the office, my final 10 years, was really fortunate. Worked with way more winning clubs than losing clubs during the course of my career, which is the mark of success in the industry. And I will admit I was along for the ride for most of that, for the first two thirds of that.
Yeah.
However, in the last part of my career, I did have a chance to take some key roles, some foundational roles with some organizations. I was a director of pro scouting with the Chicago Cubs, when they were able to win a World Series in 2016. And from there was asked to try to help do something similar with the Seattle Mariners, the last part of my career. And we were able, by the time I came to the Mariners, they had the longest non-playoff streak in North American professional sports.
Yep.
At the time, and were able to, eventually we were able to break that streak at 20 seasons, which is an awful long time to not be in the postseason. But did that for 31 seasons. And just to be honest, like most people, or quite a few people, I had kind of that moment during COVID. If you remember pro sports at the time, a lot of the leagues were operating in the bubble.
Yep.
There were no fans, and that was me. We had a front office of three people in Seattle that year. I was in a hotel for 4 months, spitting in a tube every 48 hours, hoping that I tested negative.
Yeah.
And at the end of the season, it was the first time that the in 31 seasons, the grind of the job kind of outweighed the joy of the game. And went home and talked to my family, and had the luxury to figure out what I wanted to do. And I had 2 years left on my contract, but decided to walk away from that. I didn't know what the next phase was going to be, but knew it didn't need to be that. And once I left the industry, was really just, again, fortunate. I got a lot of phone calls, how would you do this? What would you do here? How did you handle this? And at some point I was like, hey, this is the third time you called. It's not really an hour phone call. Like, bring me in for a workshop, or put me on retainer for 3 months and I'll take it on as a special project. And so I kind of fell into consulting a little bit. And at the same time, recruited by an executive coaching firm, and they talked about working with leaders, and that there's a lot of similarities sports is a high stakes, fast paced business. And there's a lot of leadership traits that apply across the board. And I've Since pivoted over to, doing the coaching and advising, and I do some work in sports, some work in the corporate world. I've worked in high tech. I've worked with startups and some founders. And again, I've just found that again, high and elite performers are high and elite performers regardless of environment. But there are some key things for the leaders within that environment and the environment themselves that have a universal quality. And I found that that's been most of the work that I've done, whether it be in culture, operations,
Yeah.
or in, how you're setting everything up. There's just some tried and trues that apply in those types of environments.
That first moment when you got approached, you didn't, you considered yourself, you didn't know what you were going to do. You considered yourself a, an experienced athletics executive. But when you were asked either by, getting recruited for a coaching firm or by a client, did you, were you surprised? Like, what was, like, did you go, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like, I knew that was coming, or, oh, I hadn't thought about that. It's like, 'cause you just kind of like, here's my, I just did it. I loved it. And then you're like, I'm not sure what's going to happen next. And then it just kind of evolved into that. What was that first moment like? Did you have a, a preceding knowledge that it was possible, or you're like, wait, what? Can I do this?
No, it's super interesting. I had the way it came about was I actually was contacted by someone. And I was hooked up with someone who was in this in the space, and he had been a former basketball coach, and he was doing this now. And the way that was kind of presented was, again, elite performers are elite performers, high performers are high performers, but they had a model where they looked for people that were longtime decision makers in military, law enforcement, the healthcare, but in like the operating room doing procedures, and oddly enough, high level sports.
Huh.
And the reason for that was twofold. They found that in those arenas, one, you understood second order effects of your decisions as a leader. You understood as a decision maker second order effects. Military, law enforcement, health, I mean, it could literally be life or death. It's not life or death in sports. Fans sometimes think it's life or death. It's not. But the reality is everything that you do is under such public scrutiny that you're very aware of what could happen. So you have that skill. I mean, we could literally make a move at 3 o'clock and talk radio doesn't like it at 4 o'clock. And our owner will call us at 5 o'clock and go, "Hey, do you guys do the right thing with this move?" And it's like, "Yeah, that's what you hired us to do. We thought about this." And so one is second order effects. And I think the other one is so many decision-making reps. You as if you're in the military, every patrol is a rep. Every in law enforcement, every shift's a rep. For us, every game's a rep. You get to plan, you get to act out, you get to feedback, you get to debrief, you get to plan again. So we really understand how to make decisions. And the way they presented it was because of the nature of those industries, if you survive a long time as a leader in one of those industries, you're almost by survivor bias a good decision maker. Because if I'm a bad staff sergeant in the military, they let me be a bad staff sergeant for about 2 weeks and then I never get to be a staff sergeant
That's
again.
it. That's it.
When that was kind of presented to me, I was like, wow, that kind of makes sense. I never really thought of it that way. But it intrigued me enough at the time. I didn't take the opportunity at the time. I was still figuring out what I wanted to do. But I live outside Chicago. So I volunteered with a nonprofit that works with executives in nonprofit firms and does some coaching and consulting. And I found it really fulfilling. And I did find that it was the arena that they had kind of talked about. And it was something that I figured, hey, if I'm going to do this, I wanted to have the right tools. I did take a course and get kind of accredited through the ICF to be able to do these things. And again, I've just, as I said, have just really found it where I didn't realize you're in the moment, so you don't really get it as you're doing it. You're just living the moment. But now that I've had a chance to look, like pro sports is about as fast-paced, a high stakes, and unforgiving environment as you could be from a business perspective. And so that does have some application in almost any other arena and helping people navigate those types of environments. Because at the end of my career, I was doing strategic planning and budgeting and all the same things that other high-level leaders are doing. It just happened to be through the business of sports.
I love that idea of the reps of the cycles. You're right, because it's like beginning, middle, and done. And the concreteness of it's starting, it's happening, it's ending. I screwed it up. I did, we did well. How do we do it again? And so to me, there's sort of this immediacy, right? You're talking about like you see, well, the second order effects. That is a really interesting idea. It's highly scrutinized, but it's also immediate. You're like, you can see it too. And you don't get that kind of pace and repetition in the sort of the business world because things are always going on and it doesn't feel as calculable or something, right? It's like maybe there's like earnings, like, or maybe you're thinking about it quarterly, but you're not thinking about how many baseball games in a season.
They play 162 in about 185 days.
Okay, so that's like that is a far cry from even if you're doing quarterly reports or even monthlies, right? So it's really, really interesting. What were your, if we're continuing this analogy, what were your how would you think about your KPIs in baseball?
Sure, and I think you have it exactly right. The feedback loops are so fast. Number one,
Feedback,
so
that's
fast.
it. That's great.
The
Feedback
feedback
loops.
loops are so fast, and the other thing is they are brutally honest, brutally honest. And to your point, when you make a decision in professional sports, you're not waiting quarters or years, to get your feedback. You find out like the next game. So for us, from a KPI standpoint, our KPI is the scoreboard. It tells us every day whether or not we did our job 162 times a year.
Whether you
And now
want
you
it or
can do that
not,
with me, whether you want it or not.
there's no
And
fudging the numbers.
exact, there's no fudging the numbers. And then the other thing is, you're from a customer satisfaction score, like there's the standings. It's anywhere you look, it's in the papers. And if you're doing well in the standings, your customers are usually satisfied. And if you're not doing well in the standings, they're not satisfied. And they tend to be very vocal about it.
That's what they're gonna tell you. Forget, it's worse than even the Yelp reviews maybe of restaurants, right?
And
They're screaming at
there
you.
have been times, I mean, I've had that with fans, like, and you'll hear sometimes, well, we don't work for the fans. Yes, we do. If fans didn't buy the tickets and buy the merchandise and watch the games and give us the media ratings, none of us would get to do this for a living. But it is, again, I go back to it. It's a business built around a game. And while we focus on the game, the business behind that is very, very unforgiving. And again, that the KPI is like every day you're getting told whether or not you did your job. You either win or lose at your job every
Every
day,
day.
that you actually go out there and play. And to your
Woof.
point with the loops, if we lose today's game and tomorrow's game starts at 7:05, they're not going to delay it for us if we're not ready. We can't kick the can. You have to be ready to go. So it's almost inherent in the industry that you can't find ways to delay or not make a decision or put something off because the next game is going to start whether you're ready to go or
That
not.
is,
And
and that's death, right? Like there's sort of this maxim of like better to make a wrong decision than not make any decision.
correct. And I'll give credit to quote unquote more traditional businesses. In pro sports, your ability to meet that deadline and go by the next game it's built into the industry. So we don't really need discipline to stay on task. We either stay on task or we don't. It's almost like survival mode. And I actually think as I've talked with other people and worked with other people in other industries, there's an extra discipline piece of holding yourself to that cadence. Like setting a fast cadence, we talk a lot about innovation in a culture or whatever it might be. You want to try and be, move fast, break things, all those phrases that you've heard. When you set that cadence, it's very easy to find ways to lengthen that cadence out and kind of drift. And so there's a discipline aspect and an accountability aspect to it that's actually harder in non-sports industries than it is in sports because that accountability mechanism is built in.
So you have put in all of your learnings into a book that just came out called Winning Inc., a championship handbook for high performing leaders. I love this idea of like the championship handbook. When you have a you I want you to talk a little bit about your chapter on culture. It's called Culture is What You Tolerate. Talk to me about how you learned that idea. Most people who are listening to this probably are familiar with that concept, but how did that come to you? Where, how did you learn that in baseball?
The culture is first of all, our culture is driven by behaviors. It's never driven by our words. It's not written, it's not on the sign we have in the break room or it's how we live as a group or a team or an organization. And I found that your behavior, and it was a quote that I found in a book that's about school cultures. As a leader, your culture is defined by your least tolerable behavior. That's your baseline. So for us, I'll just make a baseball analogy. If our culture is going to be to run, we're going to run hard to first base. That's our culture. Our culture is actually set the first time one of our players doesn't run hard to first base. How does our environment react to that? And if the player himself actually holds himself accountable, that's a really strong culture. He understands the culture. If it's a culture where a player doesn't run hard, but his peers are telling him, hey, we don't do that here, that's a good culture. That's a strong culture. The average culture is the boss has to handle it because the peers won't. But when you have an environment, we've all been there, where you kind of find a way to look away or not talk about it or not have the uncomfortable conversation, not deal with it in the moment, then your culture's not that. So if we have a player that doesn't run hard and we all find a way to look at our shoes and look at the lineup card and not actually address the player, not pay attention, act like it didn't happen, then our culture is not running hard. Our culture is that we're allowed, to not run hard. And I think for any business, whatever your culture is, whether it be, we're going to be cutting edge innovation, or we're going to be, best in class, or we're going to be customer centric. And the first time that you're not nice to a customer, well, you're not being customer centric. And how your environment reacts to those things, how your environment reacts to the behaviors that you say you don't want to tolerate, that's going to actually set how your culture actually is. So our stated cultures are what we say. Our true culture is how we behave and how we react when our behaviors fall short of that goal.
What I think is, and this goes back to the kind of how sports are is this particularly unique kind of ecosystem, is if you're talking about a run fast culture, run hard culture, and the one example of or the example that you gave is like, sprint to first. In business, if it's like we're an innovative culture, I think the challenge, the gap, the reason why this is harder in the business world is because you have to then back up and talk about, well, what are the actions? What's the running to first base version of innovation? Because innovation is a as I what I would call a lagging indicator of the actions that you're taking. And so that's where I think it sort of underscores your thesis around it's not as evident, it's not as obvious. And what I'm picking up on from our conversation is, or maybe I'll ask this as a question, is the right first move for an executive, business executive, to make, to be more like to clarify what those explicit behaviors are, what the explicit outcomes are, so that we can see them, like define that? Is that where you start?
Great question, and I think that's also the answer. It's about clarity of expectations, and I'll give each of the principles that I talk about in the book is backed up by an anecdote, a story that kind of develops it, and that story or that illustrates it, and that the story that I use in the book actually I think applies in any business environment. So I'll try to kind of condense it. I worked with the Los Angeles Dodgers when they underwent an ownership change. And anytime you have a new ownership change, it's change management. You have new people coming in on the top. You're going to have some holdovers there
100%.
that you're trying to get on board with what you're doing. You're trying to make sure that their input's taken. But usually, if an owner makes a drastic move, it's not because things are going well. It's because change needs to happen. And so I come to the Los Angeles Dodgers. We make an ownership change. I'm part of the new group coming in. So now we have the new versus old, and we had some holdovers that just weren't really on board with what we were doing. They
Always the
very much
case. It's always the case.
wanted to stay with what they were doing, and they were like, this is the Dodger way because this is the way we've always done it. I was like, yeah, but the Dodger way has been outdated for like a decade now. So we go through and we're having our introductions and our education things and our off-season calls, and there's this kind of undercurrent. There's guaranteed contracts, so we have some people that we can't really, and the new owner coming in doesn't want to get too drastic in the turnover, all the things that everyone who goes through this deals with. And so we get the spring training the first year under the new group, and we have our head of instruction, and we have these two coaches that are holdovers that are just really like digging in. Like they just have no interest in doing what we're doing, and they just don't want to get on board, and
The
they're
straight, like, explicit fuck you, we're not
yeah,
changing. Yeah.
and they're popular, and they're well-known names, and they're influential with the group, and all those things. So
Oof.
what we do our conference calls all off, so we get the spring training, and now we're going to have morning meetings every day at 8 o'clock. So our head of instruction, his name's Rick Sofield, he gets up the first day, and there's the buzz the first day, it's the first day meeting, excited, spring training starts. And so Rick's at the front of the room to start the meeting, and the two holdovers that are kind of the malcontents, they're not there. So Rick waits a couple minutes, they roll in a couple minutes late with their coffees, kind of you shuffle around, settle. And so, we have the morning meeting, set everything up, the meeting ends, and Rick says to them, "Hey, we started at 8 o'clock. We started at 8 a.m. And so the second day we have the meeting, and at 8 a.m., they're not there, and Rick just starts without them. And a couple minutes later, they go in and they're real noisy, shuffling to the back, kind of childish.
Yep.
But they're clearly making a statement that they're not on board what's going on, with what's going on. And so now we get to day three, and it's 7:59. Well, now the whole group knows what's going on. There's like 60 people at these meetings, and there's like 60 people. They all know that the kind of this is the moment. Like they're not there. It's 7:59. So what's going to do? There's a little tension. Then we had a little buzz the first couple of days because everybody's excited. Now we've got tension in the air. And at 8 o'clock on the dot, Rick gets up and walks over and locks the door and starts the meeting. And at like 8:02, like the handle starts jiggling, and then next thing like he just keeps going. And then after that, there's a big knock at the door. He just a couple people look, he just keeps delivering the meeting. Then there's like a closed fist pounding on the door, and he just keeps going, like nothing's going on. And then he does the whole meeting. And then he go, then after the meeting's over, he goes out and he fills in the two coaches on what they missed. And anyone with an eye shot is kind of watching, even if they can't see
Yeah.
what's going on. It's a pretty animated conversation. And Rick just ends it with, "Hey, we start at 8 a.m. And the funny thing is, the very next day, it might be the earliest an entire group has ever shown up for a meeting in the history of professional baseball. Everyone was there, including the two holdover coaches. So now we start at 8 o'clock. And again, that was the moment. Like, do we want to be on time? Do we want to be prompt? Do we want to be doing what the organization, is saying that we're going to do? Or are we going to let people run roughshod? And that was something as simple as showing up on time in a meeting and whether or not you tolerate that. And Rick decided he didn't want to tolerate that. And the side effect of that was not only did meetings start on time, and they weren't always comfortable, but the larger message of what we were doing started to land a little bit more because going again, it was, hey, we're just not going to stand for that. It's not going to be tolerated.
Yeah.
So that's a simple example where people showing up on time for meetings, like you can't say you're crisp, efficient, you optimize, and all these other things that we like to throw around if everybody just strolls in when they want at meetings. And that's just not professional sports or baseball. That's any business. So
That's
even something
anything.
as simple as that, just it is about the behaviors that you tolerate,
Yeah.
and it's what
Yeah.
you allow to happen, that you say you won't, but when it actually happens, that's the moment of truth as to whether or not your culture is actually what you say it is.
Yeah, maybe, it's a big ask to be like, all right, think about all the things that go into being an innovative culture. Maybe we start with one and decide what that might be. And that's kind of a good way to begin to establish those norms. It's a meta message around here is what I expect, and here is what we're going to hold you accountable to. This is, there's an expectation here. It's what we call the say-do gap, and we're going to close the say-do gap. I think that's really powerful. That's a great story. That's really good. That's really, really good. So another piece that you talk about is buy-in, and there's a lot of discussion around engagement and buy-in in business, but you don't think buy-in is actually where we should be focusing.
I don't think so. And it's not that buy-in is incorrect in and of itself. It's just not strong enough for, in my experience, what high-performing teams, high-performing organizations do. Buy-in has kind of more of a buy-in at its nature is just, oh yeah, okay, I'm willing to accept what's going on. And it's almost that buy-in is almost a decision. I prefer to I think what we're trying to build is more believe in. You want your people to believe in what they're doing and what you're doing as an organization. And we all know that we want to try and motivate people. Like what are they motivated by? What's going to make them want to come into the office and want to take on this project and want to try and create this successful solution? And to me, buy-in is buy-in sometimes is for sale to the highest bidder. And when my company's doing well and my stock price is doing well and everything's going great, yeah, I buy into that. But if all of a sudden my stock options are underwater and the project's off the rails and we're not meeting our deadline and I get a better offer to go somewhere else, I'm gonna go buy into that.
That's right.
But when you think about people that, they're bootstrapping in the garage and they're trying to make ends meet and they don't know if they're gonna make payroll and they still want to come in because they believe in what they're doing. Believe in is just a more, it's just a more powerful driver. And what I found is that you can sometimes almost order buy-in from the top down as a leader. But the reality is the best groups, they have believe in, and it comes from the bottom up. The people on the front lines, they just coalesce and they believe in what they're doing. And where that really gets stressed is in the moment in moments of adversity. What does your team do? When the fight or flight instinct kicks in, if they choose to fight, it's because they believe in what they're fighting for. It's something inside them that they believe in. And what and I do believe that the more competitive the industry, and I do believe business is competition at its heart, but the more competitive the industry, the more the internal belief and the internal drive of your people is what determines success or failure. And for me, it's not about, as a leader, it's not about demanding buy-in from the top. It's about building believe in from the bottom up so that when I lead, that my team will follow.
What is if there is a team manager listening right now, and they think, I like this idea of believe in. Is there like there's probably a couple different things they can do. What would be one thing, one place to start when we think about elevating buy-in to believe in?
I actually think it's meeting your people where they are and hitting their motivations, finding out what matters to them. Oftentimes as managers, we know what the company wants and we can articulate that down, but do we know what our people want? And I have a story, kind of a separate one, I guess, on this. I actually spoke with an NBA G League team, the young kids, it's kind of the minor leagues for the NBA. And we talked about this. How do build your people? Well, they're all motivated by different things. So I said, hey, oh, this player, oh, he's motivated by greed. He just wants to get paid. Okay. This player, oh, he wants to be great. He wants to make the Hall of Fame. Okay. This player, oh, he wants to take care of his family. Okay. This player, oh, he's about Instagram likes. Like that was literally the answer. He's about Instagram likes. And I said, okay. I said, now what's something every player needs? Any player can need better footwork. Okay, well if all the players can benefit from better footwork, I'm just going to message that differently as the coach or leader, and I'm going to try to appeal to what drives them. So for the player that wants to get paid, I might say, hey, you already have $1 million in the bank. If you want that $10 million contract, you really need to work on your footwork. We need to improve your footwork. And for the player that wants to be in the Hall of Fame, hey, if you actually want to be in the Hall of Fame one day and play at that level, you need to work on your footwork. And for the player that wants to take care of his family, hey, if you really want to buy that house for your mom, we need to get going on your footwork. Or it might be, hey, I know that you got a lot of likes when you slam dunked over the other person. If you don't improve your footwork, somebody's going to slam dunk over you, and you're not going to like that because you're going to go viral for the wrong reasons. So I think a lot of that in creating that belief is not what the company believes in, but what the people that you are leading believe in. And the more of those that you can individually flip those switches, the individual switches, the better the collective will be able to kind of come along and coalesce. They need to have something that they can share as a group, but they also need to be motivated as individuals. And I think that elite teams do that. And I think when you think of all the post-championship interviews you've ever watched, if you're a sports fan, if you've ever watched them on TV, I've never seen anyone come out and say, oh, how did we do that? Oh, we really bought into each other. They say, no, they believed in each other. We believed in each other. We believed in what we did. We believed in our game plan. We believed in what we are about. And just that intrinsic internal belief, is always stronger, than any kind of, I don't want to call it artificial, but any kind of external buy-in that you try and create through your program, through your processes. And when those two things merge together, boom, keep doing what you're doing. But at the end of the day, what people believe in is going to drive their reaction more than what they might buy into.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you've shared two of nine principles. If you liked what Joe was sharing and want to read more of his stories, you can check him out. Check out his book, Winning Inc., A Championship Handbook for High-Performing Leaders on Amazon. And also you can read out more about Joe at jbexecutivecoach.com. Joe Boringer, advisor and executive coach, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us and sharing a little bit of your journey with us on Great Mondays Radio. It was really, really entertaining.
Josh, thank you for the invite. Really hope the listeners got something out of it, and really appreciate the chance just to come on and talk a little bit. So,
Perfect. Thanks so much, man.
all right, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Great Mondays Radio. Hey, if you want to be a guest, head over to radio.greatmondays.com. And if you think this episode was interesting and your friends and fans would enjoy it, please share on social media. And if you want to get more people to understand the power of company culture in business today, please rate and review Great Mondays Radio on your podcast feed. It really helps us reach more people. If you want to hear more candid conversations with culture leaders, subscribe to Great Mondays Radio. I'd love to connect with you. Find me on LinkedIn at AKA Josh Levine, on YouTube at Great Mondays. And you can always email me, josh@greatmondays.com. Find out more about our work with hypergrowth technology and social enterprise organizations at greatmondays.com. I'm Josh Levine. Thanks for listening to Great Mondays Radio.